KALW.
I would force people into shelter. I would force people into treatment. I would force those who are on the streets into some sort of housing.
San Francisco Mayor London Breed is on the campaign trail.
When I am out there talking to voters, I'm telling them that San Francisco has one of the lowest crime rates that it's had in 10 years.
Today, her case for re-election. Then it's the next episode of our series, Fall Ball.
My worst moment's going to be the last day when the A's are officially gone.
And a reading from Berkeley author Cheryl Kaskowitz.
It's about a secret government folk music program that was part of FDR's New Deal during the Great Depression.
It's our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The San Francisco mayoral race is underway. Today, we'll hear a conversation our friends from KALW State of the Bay had with incumbent mayor London Breed. She was raised in the Western Addition and is the first African-American woman elected to the mayor's office. She previously represented District 5. Here's part of the conversation she had with State of the Bay host Grace Wan.
Mayor Breed, in 2018, when you ran for mayor for the first time, you wrote in your campaign pledge, "The city of St. Francis should never let thousands of people shiver in the cold or endure illness and addiction alone on the streets, nor should the city that knows how remain unable to improve, much less solve, the most persistent problem we face. Walking the streets of San Francisco can be frightening, demoralizing, even an unhealthy experience for residents and tourists alike. A report last month declared our streets dirtier than some of the world's worst slums, and we all witnessed the smells and sights to prove it." So that was in your campaign material from 2018. And I wanted to ask, would you say that the conditions for the unhoused and the cleanliness of the streets have improved since then? And if so, in what way?
Well, a couple of things I will say. In certain neighborhoods, most neighborhoods all around San Francisco, definitely they have improved. In that recent Chronicle poll, it showed that close to 70% of residents of San Francisco thinks their neighborhoods are great and their neighborhoods are safe. And we have helped over 15,000 people who were on the streets of San Francisco, who had been homeless, get into housing, shelter, and other opportunities since I've been in office. So we have been doing the work. We still struggle because, sadly, what we're dealing with now is it isn't just about homelessness, it's about fentanyl and what impacts the fentanyl has had on people who, unfortunately, are not always from San Francisco. This is a place that we have had people who have traveled from other places because, sadly, the ease of getting access to drugs has been very much problematic. I put together a team of people. We're getting help from the feds, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the California Highway Patrol to help us address this issue. We've made over 3,000 arrests of both dealers and users. And the approach that we're taking to try and combat this most challenging issue is to be as aggressive as we possibly can. But this is overwhelming cities all over the country. And here in San Francisco, we're taking very decisive and aggressive action to try to combat it. But we have been working very hard to get people housed, to get people clean and sober, and to get folks the support that they need. And I am very proud that we have even instituted abstinence-based solutions in our recovery, $22 million with 7 new sites. That's not just sites for programming. That's sites for housing those who were struggling with addiction and who have an abstinence-based solution to help them address those issues.
Well, you mentioned growing up in public housing and, you know, the drug crisis that you witnessed then. And now you're saying your harm reduction strategy has changed. Is that really because of fentanyl? Is that the issue that sort of shifted how you think about this?
I think that it evolved. I wouldn't say it completely changed. It evolved because of people that I grew up with who, in some cases, live in the Tenderloin, who have, in fact, suffered from substance use disorder. They are the ones providing, you know, the feedback to me about what we need to do because they have not only been in it, they are actually trying to help solve it and help address it. And they have been frustrated with, you know, the city in the past and how we invest dollars into a lot of harm reduction strategies. They're not opposed to harm reduction strategies, but they think public health resources should also be invested in abstinence-based solutions as well. So that is what I decided to do, is work with this community to provide alternatives. And it again, is not a one-size-fits-all.
You know, Mayor Breed, I hear you talking about the things that you have done for the city to make it safer, to help people who are addicted, to help people who are on the streets. And yet, a poll in the Chronicle in February states that more than 70% of those who responded disapprove of your performance. I mean, why do you think that is? And why should voters give you four more years?
Well, I think I can't speak for you know, the folks in the poll, but I will tell you that when I am out there talking to voters and I'm telling them about what I'm doing, I'm telling them that San Francisco has one of the lowest crime rates that it's had in 10 years, not including the pandemic. And I'm telling them about the over 15,000 people that we've helped off the streets and all of the things that we're doing. They are sometimes we're not necessarily aware of all of this work. And also there's a reality versus perception. You know, the reality is San Francisco is much safer than any other big city in the United States. The reality is when I was growing up, people were being killed on a regular basis. And now we have one of the lowest homicide rates of any major city in the country. So the reality is one thing, but if people are saying, I don't feel safe or I am, you know, whatever, that is the thing that we have to address. That has been the hardest thing to overcome in light of what we've seen happen in terms of San Francisco's reputation and how viral videos that may not always even be in San Francisco, that might be in the Bay Area, or in some cases, videos that have been in other cities outside of the Bay Area, attributed to San Francisco, attributed to things that are happening here that aren't necessarily happening here. And I think, unfortunately, that the challenges that we dealt with after the pandemic and the issues that people highlighted created, you know, this environment to a certain extent, and it's been very challenging to overcome.
Well, we have a question from a listener who asks, how do you balance the personal rights of the unhoused with the rights for other citizens to feel safe? What are your guiding principles in this debate? And I know the city has participated in the Grants Pass case before the Supreme Court about this, but how do you come at this on this personally?
Well, I on a personal level, I believe in force. I believe that if you know, the laws weren't so restrictive, I would force people into shelter. I would force people into treatment. I would force those who are on the streets into some sort of housing. I don't think it's, you know, okay to just say, well, someone has rights and they should be able to live on the streets and create some of the problems that are being created, whether it's, you know, the use of, you know, the outdoors as public restrooms or the use of water fountains to clean themselves, especially when we have a place for them to go. When we have a place for them to go, we should be able to force them into the place that we have available for them.
I have an email from Meg. She writes, I'm a parent of an SFUSD student, a public school teacher, and a longtime SF voter. I'm concerned because I just heard the city is cutting funding for our after-school programs. How will you ensure San Francisco students receive the consistent support they need to succeed in school, particularly in light of extreme budget constraints schools are facing? In other words, how do you rank children in how you prioritize city funds?
Well, to be clear, I've always prioritized children. And in fact, the department that the budget cuts occurred, there was an assessment. They wanted to make sure that there were some systems around accountability, and they made some decisions. I'm evaluating those decisions now to understand whether or not there were organizations that were cut that were delivering significant services that need to have funding restored. And I also, during the pandemic, There were a lot of programs that received significant increases because of private dollars. And so those dollars are no longer available. So there is some assessment work that needs to be done in order to make sure that we are not reducing services for children in San Francisco, because that truly is something important that we need to continue. And we need to make sure that especially those organizations that are actually effective and delivering good programming for our kids, that they are not impacted. That is something I genuinely care about. And if it weren't for those programs, my first job at 14, Department of Children, Youth and Family, Mayor's Youth Employment and Training Program, like all of these programs are what, you know, helped to raise me. And so those are definitely going to be programs that I prioritize.
That was Mayor London Breed talking with State of the Bay's host Grace Wan in April. You can hear a longer version of that conversation and all our election coverage at kalw.org/elections. And while you are there, tell us what local issues are on your mind for the upcoming election. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Suni Khalid, in for Hanna Baba. The Oakland A's now rank last in the Western Division. Today, the inside baseball for the next episode of Foul Ball, a season-long series looking at the A's final season in Oakland, which will also mark the end of Major League team sports in a city that once boasted four a half century ago. So sit back, relax, and listen to a dirge of what is and what once was. When we last checked in with the A's a month ago, the plucky team had just returned home from an East Coast road trip, holding its own against the Yankees and the Orioles. The team with the cheapest payroll in the big leagues was in third place in the West Division, just two games below 500. But what a difference a month makes. As of Monday, the A's sit in last place, 22 games below 500.
Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. Great seeing some of the Twins players and their kids on this Father's Day Sunday here at the ballpark. A hot and humid day and night still to come. Game two later on tonight. Twins and the A's playing a split doubleheader today to wrap up this series. Abraham Toro leads off against righty Bailey Ober.
The A's spent Sunday playing a doubleheader against the Twins in Minneapolis at Target Field, the kind of spanky new ballpark that John Fisher hopes to move the team into in a few years in Las Vegas. The Twins jumped on the A's in the first game as all-star shortstop Carlos Correa homered twice.
Here's Carlos Correa, one of the hotter hitters going in the game. His batting average alone, he's hitting .417 here in the month of June. That is the third highest of any batter in the game. As he sends this one to left field and deep, drifting back, and Duhar near the wall, turns, and it's gone! There's a start on this Father's Day Sunday, a first inning. Carlos Correa, two-run homer, and the Twins jump in front, 2-0.
The Twins overpowered Oakland in the opener, 6-2. But in the nightcap, the A's jumped on Minnesota's starter, Chris Paddock, taking an early lead.
And now Zach Gelof. Gelof 0-for-6 in the series. The stretch, the pitch. Fastball belted, deep left center field. Martin on the run, he won't get there. It's going to short hop the wall. In to score is Brown, up to second base with a double. Zach Gelof, and the A's are ahead, 3-2.
But the A's couldn't hold on to that lead. In the bottom of the eighth, Oakland reliever Danny Jimenez faced off against Twins third baseman Jose Miranda.
Pitch is hit high in the air for Miranda to deep left field. Let it soar and gone! And we are tied no more. Jose Miranda unties this ball game. It's 8-7 Twins on an upper tank job to left field. It's the seventh of the year for Jose Miranda. Lewis is seventh.
At the top of the ninth, Minnesota closer Griffin Jacks put the final touches on an 8-7 win.
Strike three called. And the Twins sweep the A's. 8-7 the final. The Twins have won 7 of their last 8. They're now 13-5 in one-run games.
The A's host Kansas City and those same Twins at the Coliseum this week, where the team is averaging a little more than 7,000 fans, by far the worst attendance in the big leagues. One wonders how many fans will be in the stands in September to watch the team with the cheapest payroll, and one that also ranks near the bottom in hitting and pitching, play their last home game in Oakland before next year's move to Sacramento. In the last episode, I spoke with Dave Stewart. The East Oakland native was the intimidating pitching ace of the A's last championship team in 1989. Today, I speak with Chris Dobbins, the co-founder and president of SOS, Save Oakland Sports, about his memories of the A's and the ultimately futile struggle to hold on to Major League team sports in the East Bay. You're basically...
Right, we're trying to fight to keep the A's with other, some other groups, but our group Save Oakland Sports, we incorporated in 2012. We haven't been very successful, unfortunately, you know, losing the Warriors to cross the bay and then losing the Raiders, which was the big, the huge. But it's been an exciting fight, if I can say it like that, to try to keep our teams in Oakland. And even though the A's are, you know, out the door next year to Sacramento, we're still fighting to try to keep them, working local political angles, trying to come up with something to try to make them stay.
What's the season been like? Because you were out in the parking lot for opening night.
I mean, it's been, I've been to about 6 or 7 games, and today we're going to go to the game tonight, so we'll see how it is on a Wednesday night. Beautiful weather expected, but probably looking about 5,000 fans. I've had a number of friends that work at the Coliseum, and all of them are, you know, very reduced hours. Everyone's really upset about it. Again, born and raised in Oakland, love the Coliseum, been going there. As a 52-year-old, been going there all my life, literally, one of the most exciting days was when our parents let us come to the games by ourselves in middle school. And so we were able to come to the games and with our friends and have a great time. It has been very depressing to be out at the Coliseum, to see players routinely get traded before they get on the free market. And then just the vibe is just really upsetting because people are very upset at what the A's ownership group has done. And I'll say this, that the Oakland political establishment is not, in my opinion, has done their side to you know, they're trying and they're saying and they're nice people, but they just haven't been able to get it together to make this, make the A stay, for lack of a better way to say it.
Well, what do you say to each other when you basically get together outside in the parking lot before the games? I mean, what can you say to each other at this point? Has the conversation changed from what it was like before the move was announced?
That's a great question. I think people reminisce a lot, like everything, right? When a good thing has come to an end, or it's going to come to an end, you know, you see where the last game of the season, September, whatever, it's a Thursday, they've almost sold the game out. And I was fortunate when the A's redid, when they did the Coliseum, when the Raiders moved back in 95, I had a buddy who worked in construction, and he got 3 of those old orange bleacher seats. If you go to the Coliseum today, in the last 30 years, they're all green, but they used to have orange seats. You know, they had different colors. And so I've got 3 of those orange seats sitting at my mom's house. So that's pretty cool. Are they going to tear down the Coliseum and give seats away this time? Probably not. But it's going to be, you know, very sad to see them go. And we'll have lost all 3 professional sports teams. I know we have, you know, the Oakland Roots and the Oakland Soul and the Ballers started yesterday, June 4th. But, those were minor league teams. So I'll say this. So when I was on the Coliseum Authority and we just lost the Raiders, there was a movement to try to get an existing franchise. So somebody stole our team, we're going to steal somebody else's. There was only 2 teams at the time, and this is late teens, that didn't have solidified, you know, stadium thing. That was the Tennessee Titans and the Jacksonville Jaguars. They didn't come, and there's only 32 teams in the NFL, and it looks like that's a good alignment at the moment. So they're not expanding. That's what I'm getting at. Baseball has 30 teams, and they're talking about expanding 2 more sites.
Dave Stewart is actually with Nashville now.
Right, and he's with and in fact, he's with Nashville and not with Oakland is very distressing. You know, St. Liz guy, met him a couple times, fantastic. Being in high school when he was getting his 20 wins every year, winning in 89 and my senior year at Skyline High School was fantastic. So I'm a big Dave Stewart guy. And right, and he should be in working with there. Now, you heard what the commissioner said was that Major League Baseball wants another team in California potentially as one of these new 2 expansion sites. I mean, people talk about Portland. My mother's Lebanese. We have family in Montreal. They're talking about going back to Montreal, Canada, and Nashville is probably the big, you know, odds on fight, and Vegas. And so my fear is that if the deal, if they raise, do go through with Sacramento, which 99% probably is going to happen next year, and the 3 or 4 years before Vegas gets built or not built, that they actually, Sacramento will keep the A's. Major Baseball put an expansion team in Vegas, which is what most probably, if you ask most Nevada people, they'd want a fresh team, fresh start in Vegas, fresh ownership, obviously. And then they're not going to put a third team in Northern California. So we would get boxed out. So, for example, Oakland is not going to get an NBA team because San Francisco and Sacramento Kings are going to block any type like that. So it's very sad. As an Oakland guy and seeing the Ballers are playing at a field called Raimondi Field. Well, the Raimondi family was a longtime baseball family in Oakland. They had a lot of businesses. The field itself is named for the brother who was killed in World War II, but the brother that played baseball for the Oaks and I think went on to the Yankees. So it's a rich baseball tradition here in Oakland. Obviously, all the guys that went through McClymans, all the Hall of Famers, you know, Curt Flood and Joe Morgan at Castlemont, a lot of these guys played great. Gary Pettis then in the late 80s, obviously Ricky Henderson, Lloyd Mosby. And then in my contemporaries, Marcus Jensen, who still plays with he's a coach for the A's, played with the Giants and everything. So there's a long tradition history of baseball in Oakland, and to not have a professional team or like a major league team is going to be sad.
What is your favorite memory, and what is going to be your least favorite memory?
Favorite memory was probably the Coliseum would be when the Raiders beat the Tennessee Titans in 2002 and went to the Super Bowl. I was 10 years old when the Raiders left to L.A., and so I kind of missed a lot of the glory years in the 70s and late 60s. So that was probably my favorite one. But as an A's one, I've been to probably 2,500 A's games. So there's just so many great ones, a lot of these great playoff wins, you know. But so one particular day, August 26, 1986, I was 8 years old, or no, I was in eighth grade, sorry. And it was a twilight doubleheader. That was one of my best friends. And we saw the A's come back in the ninth inning against the Baltimore Orioles ace, Don Ossie, both games in the ninth inning and won. It swept a doubleheader. Right, it was an innocuous game. The A's didn't win the World Series that year, but it was a great thing. But going through the ups and downs of the A's, all those years have been tremendous. You know, good times, we've seen a lot of, you know, losses in the playoffs. You know, went to a lot of those playoff games in the last 20 years in the playoffs. My worst moment's going to be the last day when the A's are officially gone. I mean, I've had, you know, again, A's stuff since I was a little kid. I was born in 72 when the A's won the World Series. Parents took me to a playoff game that year. I don't remember, but still, the fact that I was there, and so it's going to be gone. It'd be very upsetting.
Last question. What does Oakland lose when the A's leave town for good?
Amazing question. Well, first, I mean, just from a tangible standpoint, there's 700 jobs generated every A's game. There's that. But then you have the moral fabric. You know, when the A's were kicking, you know what, in the late 80s, 90s, and you had MC Hammer, an Oakland guy, on his videos and guys wearing A's hats, I mean, that was very proud to be from Oakland. I think the fact that the A's have been here the whole time, since 68. Unlike the Raiders who've come and gone, the Warriors who were in San Francisco and never called themselves Oakland. So I think Oakland A's have been the official team. I also think that football is broader, so you have much broader fan bases than Major League Baseball. So Oakland not only is going to lose the tangible economic benefits, but it's going to lose the psychological benefits of having a Major League team, being a Major League town, having, you know, people wearing that A's hat, knowing they're from Oakland. So, yeah.
They're going to put you out of business.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Save Oakland Sports will probably pivot to try to help the Oakland Athletic League. But yeah, in terms of an actual trying to keep professional sports. Now, I will say we will always keep fighting, and you know, as long as try to get new teams come in. You know, Oakland used to have a hockey team. There's only one team in the Bay Area. You know, we could get that back. Soccer's big, obviously huge. In Major League Soccer, they don't have the relegation because the Roots couldn't move up to MLS, but we can get it. We used to have the Oakland Stompers, which is part of the old professional soccer league. So we've had that. We've had minor sports as well, but you're talking about your big three. Without those three, it's very depressing.
That was Chris Dobbins, the co-founder and president of SOS, Save Oakland Sports. This is Cross Currents. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Next, how our government once tried to use music to end the Great Depression. It's an episode from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. Cheryl Kaskowitz lives in Berkeley. Her book, A Chance to Harmonize, came out in April.
It's about a secret government folk music program that was part of FDR's New Deal during the Great Depression. And this paragraph comes from chapter 2, just after the music representative Margaret Valiant arrived at her first assignment, which was a government-built homestead in Cherry Lake, Florida. Margaret realized she needed to build a team of allies, finding musicians and music lovers who would join the homestead's music committee and help to sell her planned music program to the rest of the community. Her first ally was also the first musician she met on the homestead, the accordion-playing electrician Red Stevens, who, as head of the music committee, offered his full support for her plans. She began to gather names of others said to have some musical connections, and, given the state of the roads and her lack of appropriate footwear, made arrangements to visit them by horseback.
That was Berklee author and Audio Academy alum Cheryl Kaskowitz. Her book, A Chance to Harmonize, came out in April. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. Tune in Monday morning at 11. The go-to party supply store in the East Bay is shutting down.
Are you guys closing? Yes. And where are you guys moving? We're not moving. We are closing the store. Oh, no. What should I do? It's like, I said, oh, what should we do? I mean,
final party at Paper Plus. That's Monday morning at 11. The Cross Currents team includes Aru Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, James Rollins, Gonady Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adel, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.